Entertain a motion at this point to approve the minutes of the January 28th meeting.
So moved.
Representative Hertaus moves the minutes approved. Any additions or corrections at this point? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are approved. We're going to move right along with our only bill on the agenda today, and Representative Carlson. Representative Carlson, welcome to the committee. And the chair at this point will move House File 140 to be considered to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Welcome, Representative Carlson.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to, first of all, apologize. You had it scheduled the other day, and it was a little mix-up. I was in the building, but I didn't realize that the bill was going to be up before the committee. So
it worked out great, Representative Carlson,
okay.
Actually.
So otherwise, I would have been here, but appreciate your following it up with a second hearing. This is a bill that deals with targeted property tax relief, and under current law, if the property taxes on a home increase by more than 12% over the previous year, and if the increase is over $100, you can qualify for a special credit. So it attempts to cover those sharp spikes that occasionally would take place. The credit, the way it operates, you would get 60% of the amount over 12% or over $100 with a maximum of $1,000. Now, that's current law. The bill makes one simple change if you have the bill before you. The bill would reduce that 12% to 10%. And what that would mean for property taxpayers in that situation, it would provide property tax relief statewide of $1.23 million per year. And that's the estimate for each of the next 3 years, 17, 18, and 19. The impact would be that they would pick up an additional 14,000 homeowners with that change. And my recollection, and I did double check with staff this morning, although it might take some further research, but I think at one time, and as a fairly short-term member is what I said, you know, I sometimes, things get a little vague over time, like 42 years. And if I might digress for a quick minute, by the way, yesterday, Phyllis Kahn and I were at the Humphrey Institute when I referenced the 42 years program hosted by Steve Swigum. He put it together, and it was honoring our 42 years of service, and we were on a panel then talking about how the legislative process had changed from when we first served 1973 until currently. And it was an interesting panel. There were 80-some people that were there, and including a former attorney general and a former secretary of state. Now I'm digressing a bit, but my point is that I think in the past, it was when it was originally passed, it may have been 10%. That we can double check on, but as sometimes happens with state budgets, there's sometimes some changes in a program, and I think that was one when it went from 10 to 12. So that's the bill in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman, and as a member of the full tax committee, I understand when a bill is heard and then laid over for possible inclusion. So,
thank you, Representative Carlson. Questions, members, for Representative Carlson? Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Carlson, do you have an idea of the proportionality of those additional ones that qualify that are not in incorporated areas?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, if I understand your question, you mean how much their rebate might increase? Or maybe you could expand on what you mean by the question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a mention that there'd be additional people that would be able to qualify. I was just curious as to which ones were in unincorporated areas as opposed to in a city or...
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any idea on that breakdown.
Mr. Hines, any idea at all? We probably don't have an idea at this point. Other questions, Representative Quam? Other questions, members? Mr. Hines, excuse me, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if Mr. Hines knows when it was 10%, because I think I recall that day, but I don't think I was serving.
Mr. Hines.
Representative Erickson, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, I don't either. Representative Carlson asked me this morning, and my recollection is that it was 10 at some point for some time, but I can't say for sure. I'm looking at Ms. Manzi, but we don't know. We would have to check. It's certainly been a while ago, if it was.
Other questions, members? Mr. Hines, could you just quickly enlighten us on the relationship again between this property tax refund and the regular one, and how that interaction works, Mr. Hines?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. This is usually referred to as the special property tax refund, and so it is filed at the same on the same form as the regular the homestead credit refund, which is the one where your refund is based on your taxes relative to your income. So the level of your property tax relative to your income determines how much you get under the homestead credit refund, the big program that really distributes a lot of money. This program, though it's on the same form, is unrelated to income. And it simply says if your property taxes exceeded 12% increase over the previous year, or over $100 plus over $100, then you qualify for this refund. So you file it at the same time. But some people we think maybe don't know they're eligible because they assume it's income related, and this one is not.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. So, Mr. Hines, is this added? Can you add one on top of the other then when you fill it out, Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, you can't really benefit from adding the two together, and we changed the order of which one comes first. I believe this one is now taken first. I'd have to verify that, but there isn't any advantage to bundling them together. But there can be a situation where you could qualify for both of them in the same year. Yes.
Okay. I think I did read that in the materials. This one comes first. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, as an example, you know, sometimes things happen within a community, and if you're familiar with the Northwest Suburbs, now this is ancient history, but there used to be a large shopping mall there, and there was a major court case at one point in terms of what the value of it was, and that had some property tax impact for both the school district 281 Robbins Hill and then the city of Brooklyn Center. And then later it was tore down, and now there's new redevelopment there. But now how many homeowners might have had that kind of a spike with the loss of one of the major, you know, property tax contributors, I don't know, but that's just an example of what sometimes can happen in a community that causes a spike, and probably everybody around the table could give an example of something that took place in one of their communities that might have changed the property tax base rather dramatically as a result of, in this case, court case and or removal of a large commercial venture building. It's one of the oldest malls in the Twin Cities.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Members, any other questions? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, I think most people support the idea of doing whatever can be done to lower property taxes and make it less regressive. But I want to just recall a circumstance when it was decided that the state would take over K-12 funding and education. There was a significant drop in property taxes, and at that very same time, because there was such a significant drop and taxpayers were receiving relief, it seemed like a large majority of school districts floated referendas and took advantage of that opportunity to get more revenue when there was relief. So my question is kind of a conjecture, if you will. Do you think that in providing a rebate system like this that is not income-based, that it would create an incentive for local governments to go ahead and raise their levies or budgets, knowing that any increase would be subsidized by a rebate or a discount?
Conjecture, it doesn't happen here, Representative Hertaus. Representative Carlson.
You know, that would be a conjecture on my part. I don't really know, although I do remember, you know, I go back, I wasn't here when the Minnesota Miracle passed, but I was here the session after, and I was on the tax committee that term, and we did a lot of the fine-tuning of the Minnesota miracle. So sometimes I almost feel like I was part of it, even though it was the law.
So you were a product of the miracle.
And, and we spent a lot of time on it. But if I recall correctly, when the Minnesota miracle was passed, and now we're dealing with some more history that I'd have to rely on maybe some others, but I think that also incorporated some levy limits to get at the very question that you're raising. In fact, I'm very sure of that because the school district I represented, Robbinsdale, at the time had some excess funds, and they lowered their levy, and bang, the Minnesota miracle passed, and they got locked in at that lower levy, and they couldn't go back up. And one of the very first school-related bills that I had was to allow them over a period of time to levy back up to the Hennepin County average, because they just got caught with that low levy, and that coupled with the levy limits was creating some financial difficulty for the Robbinsdale School District. How many others were caught in that, I don't know, but that was one of the largest at the time, almost 30,000 students.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, just being familiar with some of the demographics of our suburban communities, there are those certain communities that have a disproportionate amount of what might be referred to as entry-level housing. And so with that, generally the tax base is lower, and that 10% threshold is going to be reached quicker and certainly will benefit certain communities. Moreover, as a community, obviously there are low property valuations on specific homes in every community, and those people would be targeted, but that was the basis behind my question, if certain communities are going to really benefit from something like this based on their housing stock.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Members, any last questions? Mr. Hines has a comment.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Manzi has brought up an answer to the question about the 10%, and sure enough, it was 10% as recently as 1992. A number of years, 89 through 92, it was 10%, and back in the 80s, there were some periods when it was 10%. So it's been 12 ever since 92, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Members, seeing no other questions, the chair will lay this bill over, House File 140, for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Okay, we are going to do that long-awaited dive into fiscal disparities, and our research staff, I think, is going to lead us. I don't know who's going to lead us, but we'll find out here soon. Mr. Hines, I think, is going to lead the discussion. And I see he's got a very thick collection of papers there.
Take us a minute to get
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hines. Whenever you're ready to proceed, we're ready to get started on the fiscal disparities discussion. Thank you for preparing this today.
Mr. Chairman, this is being presented strictly to get members up to speed, so obviously I would welcome any questions as we go, if that's the commissioner's or the chairman's prerogative as well. In your folders today, you've got a printout of the slides that I'm going to be using in the presentation. And then there's a couple other items I just wanted to mention in that we also put in your folders today. One is a two-page description of the fiscal disparities program that hopefully will is a kind of a quick overview of the whole thing that might be useful. And then we also included a printout of the current year's list of each city status or contribution and distribution amounts, the kind of the sometimes referred to as the winners and losers list, for you to see the up-to-date information on which communities are net gainers or net contributors under fiscal disparities. So I'm not going to directly reference that in the presentation, but you're obviously free to look at that as you will. The fiscal disparities program in the Twin Cities, and I should maybe add that there is also a parallel program to this program that exists on the Iron Range that covers the same exact areas covered by the Taconite Homestead Credit, and it works. The mechanics are identical. It's a much smaller scale program just because there's a lot less commercial industrial property up there, and it has been in operation for a shorter period of time. That program started in the 90s, and this program started in the 1970s. Actually, the Metro program was enacted in 1971. There were some court challenges before it could initially even go into operation, so the first year of operation was actually 1975. And just to say what the program is, it's a program that shares commercial industrial tax base between all the communities in the metropolitan area. If you read the program itself and the documentation or the debates that went on when the program was passed, there seem like there are basically two sort of overarching goals to the program, or two different avenues of improvement that the authors thought this would make. One is that it was done to promote more orderly regional development. This was passed shortly after the creation of the Metropolitan Council, and in a lot of ways it's seen kind of as going hand in hand with the Met Council, although the Met Council does not in and of itself actively participate in this program, but for a very, very small role and doesn't really derive money from it. Other than one little footnote to that, the second goal is improving equity in the distribution of fiscal resources. Obviously, there's a redistribution of property wealth in the program, and that was also seen as a goal.
So Mr. Hines, the orderly regional development, what do we remember about that? There was discussion a couple of meetings ago about water and sewer infrastructure, and is there any additional detail you remember about that?
Mr. Chair, let me get to that on the next slide.
Okay,
and then we can come back to the specific question of the last bill if we want. The next slide, we itemize a few of the effects of fiscal disparities that sort of contribute to one or both of those goals. The first one that we talk about is that it spreads the fiscal benefit of business development attracted by regional facilities. So that was a kind of a key concept, that there were going to be these regional approaches made to where things would be located, especially freeways, freeway interchanges, but also airports, stadiums, that kind of thing. And those were going to, in some ways, be somewhat picking winners and losers in terms of where commercial development might go. So this was seen as a way to make that the results of those decisions less catastrophic for those who are not selected for the key locational elements of the regional systems, and more distributing of whatever good things came development-wise across the area. Another thought was that it would make communities more willing to accept low-yield regional facilities such as parks, so that communities would be willing to give up property for parkland, for instance, knowing that they would still be getting benefits from commercial industrial development that might be locating elsewhere. A third point was that it equalizes the imbalance between local government's public service needs and financial resources. So this gets at the idea of the redistribution that goes on, that there's wealth. Some communities just didn't have enough tax base to support the services they needed without exorbitantly high tax rates, and this would help that situation. Reduces the incentive for businesses to relocate to areas with low tax rates. So that was a concern, that if you had a situation of a diverse range of tax rates across the area, you might find that as the business location decisions got made, they would tend to locate in the areas with low tax rates that might tend to enhance the wealth of those areas, making their tax rates potentially even lower, and vice versa for the ones who did not get selected. And finally, reduces the incentive for communities to offer tax concessions to attract businesses, so it reduces urban sprawl. So this was a thought about the term that we used to use. You don't hear as much more smokestack chasing, or that this was thought to be a disruptive behavior when communities were each pursuing these kinds of developments on their own, and that this would cut down on that, and which would sort of be good from a number of reasons, but one of which was the sprawl idea, that this was kind of contributed to the more orderly development if you didn't have businesses chasing those low tax rates by always going further and further out, I guess. So those are, at least, I think, as we've read the materials over the years, trying to synthesize into major points that people raised in connection with how this program worked and contributed to those goals of orderly development. So as far as your question about sewer system, there's nothing particular about that that would be suggested by these points. But obviously, the regional sewer system is one of the major regional systems that we have, that is through the Met Council, and might lead to some questions about whether that should be considered this program or not. But we can maybe get into it later too.
Thank you.
More specifics on that. So how does the program work? Each community has to make a contribution to something called the area-wide tax base. And this contribution is 40% of the growth it's had since 1971. So for most communities, or many communities, basically 40% of their CI goes into the pool. For the cities that had a significant commercial industrial base in 1971, it's not quite 40, it's 40% of the amount since 71, but it ends up being a pretty percentage of between 30% and 40% that goes into the pool, and they contribute this, meaning it's no longer available for them to tax locally. It is now sort of gone from their tax system, and in this theoretical concept called the area-wide tax base. And then this area-wide tax base is then distributed to each municipality through a formula that's based on the municipality's population and its relative tax base wealth, tax base per capita. So it more or less goes out in proportion to population, although if your population is only half the average, you basically get to double your population. So it's related to population wealth, but population is the major factor. Now, this distribution value that you get from the pool, you get to tax that at the same rate as you tax the other properties within your boundaries. So that's sort of the beauty of the system, is that you get this tax base, but you have to, you tax it at the same rate as you're taxing yourself. So if you have a low tax rate, you don't get as much from the pool. If you have a high tax rate, you do, but then your residents are paying a high tax rate as well. A lot of times when we discuss this program, including me today, I will use the term municipality,
because most of the data that you see about the program is produced on a municipal basis. But in fact, the other types of taxing jurisdictions in the metro area participate exactly the same way. So school districts, counties, even special taxing districts, they each have a contribution amount. They each get a distribution back. It's just that the calculations are sort of done at the municipal level, and once you sort of relocate that tax base, distribute it to a municipality, then the taxing other jurisdictions that levy taxes within that municipality also get to tax that distribution tax base.
Representative Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hines, is it the Department of Revenue then receives these distributions and then redistributes them? So who's the fiscal agent?
Mr. Hines.
Good question, Representative Erickson. The Department of Revenue similar to the Met Council, the Department of Revenue does not have a big role in this program either. They do kind of give a broad oversight to the program, and they do one or two of the calculations involved in the formula. But by and large, this program is just administered by the seven counties operating together. They elect one county to be the sort of the fiscal agent for the program, and ever since its inception, they've elected Anoka County. So Anoka County has been the chief county administratively on this program ever since its inception, but that's subject to, I believe it's an annual vote or it's a periodic vote, and it could be changed. And they do charge back their administrative costs to the other counties as well. But the money itself doesn't actually, the property taxes paid to fiscal Springs don't go through the Department of Revenue. They go strictly get paid to the counties. Then the seven counties, they actually distribute the money amongst themselves on the big picture, or the major redistribution, and then within the counties, obviously the counties are used to distributing the property tax revenues. And that's how that works.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, Anoka County is probably the fiscal agent, because I think Representative Lencheski has told us numerous times that Charlie Weaver's father created this program. Is that not correct, Representative Lencheski?
Representative Lencheski, you want to comment on that one?
I do think, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, you know, I don't know if it's his father or his uncle, but I always find it a little ironic that a conservative came up with a wealth redistribution program.
Well, conservative is a relative term, Representative Lencheski. Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lencheski, it is actually his father. And I should have probably mentioned at the beginning that in statute this law is called the Charles R. Weaver Metropolitan Revenue Distribution Act, I believe, was renamed back 20 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. So, with all of I've described the contribution and distribution amounts. When you get down to how does it actually affect individual property owners, for most types of property, it's reflected in the city's tax rate or the county's tax rate, the school district's tax rate. So as a homeowner, apartment owner, you're not very aware of it. But if you're a commercial industrial property owner, you're affected because your property tax statement actually shows that a part of the property tax is typically 30% to 40% of the local part of your property tax statement is just shown as going to fiscal disparities. So only, you know, the remaining part, the 60% to 70%, pays to local communities, and there's a portion that just goes into fiscal disparities that shows on the statement. And sometimes this has been kind of an issue that the division has had to address over the years, because taxpayers sometimes come in on like truth and taxation hearings and they don't know who they can raise issues with about that portion of their statement. The idea of truth and taxation is you go to your local city, county, etc., explain why they need to be their levy, their certain amount, but there's nobody there to explain why the fiscal disparities is as it is. The next set of couple slides are something that some people have found helpful over the years in understanding, and some maybe not, and I apologize for the scale of this. This is an old graphics thing that we did years ago that I still try to make some use of. I'll try to go through these kind of quickly. But this is meant to show a pictorial diagram of what's going on. So in this first slide here, we see three different hypothetical cities, each with a different mix of properties of commercial, industrial, homes, and apartments. And City A, in this case, has a very large amount of commercial industrial relative to its population. City B is more mixed with some residential and some commercial industrial. And then City C, primarily residential, just a little bit of commercial, just to give a little flavor for the range of things that there could be. So this is how the properties actually lie. But then the next slide, slide two, is meant to show what the situation is after you make the contribution to fiscal disparities. And if you can sort of see what we're trying to show there, each of the commercial and industrial properties has a chunk of it missing to represent the tax base that's left in the city, in each of the cities. And then down in the lower right corner of the slide, you'll see this this theoretical concept called the area-wide pool, which contains these missing pieces of the buildings from City A, City B, and City C. That's showing that those cities have given up that part of their tax base of the property within their boundaries to the area-wide pool. And then in the third slide, slide C, it's showing the situation then after the distribution from the pool occurs. And now in each city, you can see that some of that building value from the area-wide pool has been given to the individual City A, City B, and City C. And in some cases, the amount they've now got is more than they had at the beginning. And in some cities, it's less than they had at the beginning in terms of the tax base. So, again, some people this may help understand it, but this is just nothing new compared to what I've been saying. This just shows it more graphically or visually. And we may try to update this graphic for the next time. It's maybe ready for some new technology.
The computers nowadays will get you on a great track there, Mr. Hines.
Yeah, your mouse can move the ball.
Very good. So having kind of described the theory of the program and kind of how it works, now we're going to get into some data. And the next slide is just to show the growth.
Mr. Hines, if we could, Representative Vogel has a question maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Presenter. I'm having a little trouble understanding how the businesses actually pay in what rate. Is it the city's levy rate, the county's levy rate, or how do they get assessed for the what they're going to contribute?
Mr. Hines.
Sure, Representative Vogel, Mr. Chair. As I said, each commercial industrial property taxpayer has a percentage of its local tax that goes on the area, something called the area-wide tax rate. So, for instance, in your given city, you might have 65% of your property value is going to pay the local tax rate, the county rate, city rate of your localities. 35% of the property is going to pay a rate that's called the area-wide tax rate. And that area-wide tax rate is, so that's the same for every commercial industrial property anywhere in the metro is going to pay some part of its value based on this area-wide rate. And that area-wide rate ends up being kind of approximately an average metro tax rate. An average metro total tax rate. It ends up being a little higher than most for reasons we can get into if we have time, but it's the same everywhere. That was kind of the idea of why this reduced competition for businesses to locate in places with low tax rates. They were going to be having a significant part paying this area-wide rate no matter what city or county or city or town they located.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel, Representative Vogel and Mr. Hines. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, when all of the shuffling is done here and the area-wide pool is put together, any idea how much additional administration cost has resulted from that, or is it a very big percentage of the total amount?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know the amounts, but I have, when I've inquired about that from Anoka County, I've always been amazed, or I've thought the number was really quite modest, and I couldn't tell you exactly what it is, but I think they do tend to run it very bare bones operation. You won't find anything on the Anoka County website about fiscal disparities. They don't sort of go out of way to have groups that present anything about fiscal disparities to people, so they really keep it to the minimum amount of calculations that have to be made, and but I could try to get that information from you. I'm sure it wouldn't be hard, but it's always struck me as a modest amount.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
All right, so this next slide now looks at the fiscal disparities tax base as a percentage of the total tax base in the metro area. So that upper line, the pool is a, the lower line, let's look at the dotted line, just to kind of give a flavor for how significant is fiscal disparities in the metropolitan area. And as you can see, that line is right about at 10%. So easily the way to say it is about 10% of the taxes paid, the property taxes paid in the metro area, actually do go through the fiscal disparities, pass through the fiscal disparities pool in some ways through that mechanism. So now it's been, it grew, when the program started, obviously it was at a much lower number because it was related to the growth since 71. But as you can see, it actually reached 10% in about 1990, and it really hasn't grown too much. There's been some periods where it's gone above the 10% line, but it's kind of held almost constant for quite a long time now. And the upper line is kind of a similar question: how much of the total commercial industrial tax base is in the pool? And there, again, it's right now it's about 35%. It had been up to 40% or almost 40 at one point. It could never be higher than 40, of course, because it's 40% is the most anyone would contribute, with a minor with a minor exception. But it reached 30% way back in the early 90s, and it's been sort of steadily increasing but very slowly kind of since then. And it's gone down since 2010. It can go up and down a little because there's a one-year lag between when you determine each community's contribution and the amount they contribute. So when the commercial industrial values are rising, you tend to get contribution percentages that are a little low because the amount you contribute is really 40% of last year's amount, and when you compare it to this year's amount, it could be less than the 40. On the other hand, we've had periods recently where where commercial industrial property values are falling, and you could actually get to above 40% when you look at the contribution because it's in last year's terms, whereas this year your commercial industrial has fallen. You could actually end up being above 40% in any given year. But that's why it did get so close to 40 in that one year of 2010 or 11. But it'll hover around that 35 to 40% now from now on.
Representative Quam has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you sort of answered the there's a limit of 40, but there's exceptions. Does the verbiage of the law say that it's capped at 40?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, it effectively says that because it says you contribute 40%. So, you know, on a theoretical basis, it can't be more than 40. Kind of because of this one-year lag feature, in any given year, it could float a little bit. It could end up being a little above 40 because of the specifics of the circumstance of whether your commercial industrial base declined or increased from one year next, but it would never be over 40 continuously. You just could have one year, a year or two where that might happen, but it would typically fall back down. And it can't keep growing beyond 40 because you never have to put in more than 40%.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then we're to assume that in the infinite wisdom of the drafting of this, that there's a correcting factor to return any money that's above the limit of 40 if that happens to occur.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, no, there's nothing like that in place. We could have had factors in the past, I haven't checked, but where cities were above 40 in any given year for a year or even a two-year run, like 41 or 42, but there's that would just happen. There's nothing that would limit that from happening. It's just that in the long run, it's not going to be above 40. You could just have a year-to-year fluctuation.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds as if there may be a corrective or need for a corrective bill. Someone may have a visit for assisting in crafting that.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, if the thing that would correct this is if we could get rid of the lag. Right now, we say because of the computations that have to take place, we say, for instance, when you're determining your pay 15 contribution and distribution amounts, we use it on pay 14 values. So it could be that your 40% of your pay 14 ends up being more than 40% of your pay 15, but you know, by the next year or two, that typically would go away. But if we could make it where your pay 15 was based on your pay 15 value, then you would never be above 40%. So that lag it's kind of one of the prices you pay for this lag. And there's been there was a study done about three or four years ago about whether we could get rid of this lag. And the administrators really came back and said, you know, no, you can't. We can't get all the calculations done on the same year basis. We have to do it with using the previous year amounts.
Thank you.
Now the next slide is also looking at over time. The actual amount of the levy. So the last tax base was talking about the tax base and its percentage of the total. This is just to show you the actual amount of dollars distributed through the pool. And you can see that for 2015, the number is $593.8 million, which again is about 10% of the total metropolitan area property taxes. And you can see that it's grown fairly steadily from about 2005 on. There was a big drop from 2001 to 2002 when we did the last major property tax reform, and it kind of took the state general education levy, eliminated it. That resulted in the pool decreasing by a fairly good amount. It looks like it maybe came down over 100 million from 2001 to 2003. But since then it's been growing again. And there, you know, normally it will grow. It just when something unusual happens that can cause it to go the other direction. But normally it grows each year because commercial industrial tax bases grow. The 40% contributed in growth, and that just keeps the thing growing. It's grown fairly modestly these last few years. You can see that the curve has kind of leveled out. Now, in the next slide, we get into the even more interesting things about starting to show sort of where the redistribution occurs. And this first slide here is showing at the county level how much each county contributes to the pool and how much they get back from the pool. This is for pay 15. As you can see, the first thing that maybe you notice is on the left, on the contribution side, Hennepin County is almost exactly 50% of the pool. So about 50% of the value in the pool comes from Hennepin County, with Ramsey and Dakota each being about in the upper teens. Anoka and Washington are in the upper single digits, Carver, Scott in the lower single digits. And for pay 2015, for the first time ever, now we see a slight sliver for the state of Minnesota. That relates to the state actually contributes a little bit of tax base to the pool, which is the result of a law change that we made in, I believe, 2013. having to do with a Bloomington Mall of America provision that was a repayment of an old loan that the state agreed to take over from the city of Bloomington. And so for 4 years, that's just, it goes on for 4 years, the state of Minnesota will be playing a small role in the fiscal disparities pool. On the distribution side, you'll see that Hennepin County is also the biggest amount recipient from the pool. However, their slice of that pie is much smaller than the amount they put in, 50% versus about 37%. You can see now Anoka County is the one who has the biggest difference probably between the amount they put in. They put in 7% and they get out about 14%, so twice as much as they put in, more or less. Ramsey County gets back more than, really I should say, I should have started by saying every county gets out more than they put in except Hennepin. Now it's very small amount difference for Dakota, and Scott and Carver get pretty comparable amounts out to what they put in. Ramsey and Anoka get really considerably larger amounts back than they put into the pool. And this pattern has been, you know, similar for many years. If you did this, if you pull up this slide from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it looks very similar to this. The shares have not changed a whole lot. Carver and Scott counties have been getting bigger noticeably, but again, they're, since their contribution and distribution percentages are about the same, they haven't affected the others as much. They haven't affected the size of the others. So this pattern of Anoka and Ramsey getting quite a bit more out than they put in, and Hennepin getting quite a bit less, has been constant for many years. And I think the next slide is actually then just okay. The next slide is getting at now, in terms of, what does this mean in terms of actual tax burdens? And to answer this question, we did a simulation. The most we occasionally have simulated what would the world look like without fiscal disparities, which is, I always have to counter, it's a modified version of what would the world look like, because for all we know, if we didn't have fiscal disparities, businesses might have decided to locate elsewhere. And we have no way of knowing that, and we make no attempt to get at that. But if we assume that businesses located where they are now, but fiscal disparities didn't exist, what is the impact that it's had on property taxes? And so this shows, just for averages by county, what the impact would be. So you see that in the most, and it looks at two kinds of properties, homesteads and commercial industrial. And really, apartments, other types of property would pretty much look the same as homestead. So homestead property, but commercial industrial will look different than the others. So the biggest effect, Anoka County on average, and these vary quite a bit within the county, so keep that in mind, but Anoka County homeowners benefit 8.3% from the fiscal disparities program. Smaller amounts than for all the other counties, and as I said, Hennepin County is the only one that's showing an average net negative impact, although it's only about 0.5% on the homestead taxes in Hennepin County on average. And whether that's more or less than you were guessing the effect would be, I don't know, but some people feel that way, that they're surprised it's not more. We'll get into some cities here a little bit in a few more slides. Commercial industrial property looks somewhat different. Almost all the counties, looks like all the counties except one, commercial industrial properties actually have taxes that are a little bit higher because of fiscal disparities. Even in Anoka County, even though their homesteads benefit by 8%, so that tip, that would tell you that their local taxes are, rates are considerably lower. There's a phenomenon that because the business property has to pay 35% of its property into the pool, it ends up paying more than it would be if it was just purely local taxes in a place like Anoka County, which has generally low tax rates. So there's a lot of things going on in that slide, but just as more of this a reminder that there was a takeaway that commercial industrial properties' impacts are different than the homesteads. Ramsey County is the only place where there's enough benefit from a lower local rate to offset having to pay this area-wide rate that they're better off on a county average basis. Now we'll drill down even a little bit further into looking at some individual cities. And I should maybe add that on that simulation I referred to, there's actually a run, and we haven't talked about property tax simulations in here yet. I think we're going to do that at an upcoming meeting. But you can find on our website, it's actually referenced on the back of this two-pager, a city-by-city listing that shows the impacts on every type of property in every city of fiscal disparities in 2012. So this, I just went through that simulation and picked out, I think, the eight cities here that had the largest homestead tax reductions because of fiscal disparities. And so a couple things to note, that the impacts on these 10 largest cities are, the highest one that we got was about a 15% reduction in the homeowner's tax due to fiscal disparities, between 10 and 15 on these largest eight. You'll notice that most of the cities referenced here are in Anoka County. Again, this is consistent with the idea that Anoka County really is the county that's the most easily to identify as a beneficiary of this program. Another factor of why the places that tend to have the biggest homestead impacts is these are places that generally have pretty high tax rates. So this table shows the tax rates without fiscal disparities and with fiscal disparities, and these without fiscal disparities rates of these eight cities are somewhat high compared to average, and that's why they're tending to show up on the top end of this range. The next slide then is the converse of which cities have the largest homestead tax increases because of fiscal disparities. So where are the homeowners most impacted negatively by fiscal disparities, if you want to put it that way? And the magnitude of the effects here for these eight cities is between, looks like typically 5-7%. The largest one for this for 2012 happens to be the city of Oak Park Heights in Washington County. Interestingly, the second highest city is Rogers, the one that we had the bill presented the bill earlier. Then third is Bloomington, that we've often heard Bloomington's issues with fiscal disparities program. Here, six of the eight cities listed on the most affected are in Hennepin County. So again, consistent with that notion that Hennepin County typically is not do that well under fiscal disparities. Generally, the tax rates in these places are relatively low, the ones that are negatively impacted. But again, even the highest impacted ones are still considerably less than 10% on a homestead property. Switching now to the commercial industrial properties, the 10 largest and this is what the largest reductions due to fiscal disparities. Some of the same cities are in this list, and their range is from 7 to 19%. Although the 19 is kind of an outlier, so it's basically 7 to 10%, except for this one city that's Hamburg. And I picked any cities. I didn't put a population threshold in there. I think that's a pretty small city with an extraordinarily high tax rate, so there might be something unusual happening there in 2012 even. It is interesting perhaps to note that Brooklyn Center in Hennepin County does show up on this list, so even though they're in Hennepin County, the city of Brooklyn Center benefits enough from fiscal disparities that its commercial industrial properties do get a significant benefit from the program. So especially useful to think in thinking about Hennepin County to realize that they're not uniformly losers under fiscal disparities. Many Hennepin County communities do come out ahead, but not the majority. The next slide, and really the last slide I had, is then just the flip side of this one, which is commercial industrial properties with the highest increases. And these tend to be So these are in the range of the teens in percentages. Again, these always are places that have relatively low tax rates. So there's a big penalty on them having to pay that area-wide rate, which the area-wide rate, just for reference, is about 160%. And these tax rates, you see, are around 110%. So they're quite a bit of a premium in some ways. That 35% that's paying the area-wide rate is paying a much higher tax than the 65% paying 105% local rate. So those are all the materials that I prepared. As I said, there's a printout on our website that is referenced there that shows city-by-city impacts from payable 2012. We've periodically done reports. There's about a 50-page report on fiscal squares that actually is now about almost 10 years old, so I think I should redo that one this interim, but that can give more detail on some of these things. And you know, by and large, the overall pattern of fiscal disparities has been fairly constant over the years. So even the 10 years ago, a lot of these same cities would be on that list from 10 years ago that they are in this list. So you can still benefit some from looking at that. I guess I'll leave it there.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple comments and a couple questions. You know, in one of the early slides, it details in bullet points the program works to achieve its goals. And one of the goals is to reduce incentive for business to relocate to areas with lowest tax. It would seem that on these last charts that it has been a failure, because there's clearly cities where it is incentive to relocate to cities with the lowest tax. So I think in many respects, you know, spreading the financial benefits, you know, attracting regional facilities, I think it could be argued that there's a lot of suburban communities within the 7-county area that don't benefit from regional facilities and don't even have regional facilities yet, especially as laid out by the Met Council's comprehensive plan. So as to a question, in the one slide, it says contributions to the area-wide tax base, and it says each taxing jurisdiction annually contributes 40% of the growth in its CI tax base. So is that compounded year over year? How is that figured, or is that annually each year if you have more than 40% of growth?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, it's actually a very simple calculation, but it always confuses people. Each year, you just look at how much commercial industrial you have, how much did you have in 1971, subtract those numbers, and take 40%. So it doesn't care about new buildings versus old buildings, about inflation. It just is purely if you have $2 million in tax capacity now, and you had $500,000 in tax capacity in 71, 1.5% is your growth since 71. You put in 40% of that. The next year it could be less if your CI value went down. That 40%, you could contribute less in one year than you did in the previous year if your commercial industrial dropped. But that's the only way we would contribute less.
So virtually,
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So virtually, if you were in 1971, a second or third or fourth suburban ring community with not much commercial development, if that's the threshold, you're forever locked into this 40% growth.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. I often will cite that if you had basically no CI in 1971, you're basically putting in 40%.
Yep. Mr. Hines, have there been any attempts at reestablishing that 1971 date to another date to reestablish a baseline, or in your recollection?
Mr. Chairman, there have been proposals to eliminate that subtraction, to just make it a straight 40% for everyone. But there's not, other than that, nobody's advocated moving it to a different date that I can recall.
Thank you. Chair Lincheski. Representative Pinto. Sorry, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be quick. I just wanted to understand something on the chart. The combined total tax rate on these series of charts, can you explain that? Because I'm confused because a number of the numbers are above 100%, so I'm trying to figure out what the base is in calculating that combined total tax rate.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, you're getting into one of the complicated aspects of our system. The 100% tax rate is just a number. No particular significance to 100%. So the way our property tax system works is the county computes our tax rates are expressed as a percentage of tax capacity. So the county might levy a tax of 33% of tax capacity. The city might levy a tax of 30% of tax capacity. The school district might levy a tax that's 30% of tax capacity, and the Housing and Redevelopment Authority could levy 10%. Those numbers added together are over 100%. There's nothing magic about 100%. At the time the system was put in place, total average tax rates were around 100%, but that's as far as you could go with it. So this is a combined rate, city, county, school district, and this is also a little bit of a rate you won't see elsewhere because as you may also be aware, we've talked about, there's also a market value tax rate, and that basically applies to school referendum levies, and I've added that piece in here to sort of so that I can talk about a single rate for a place rather than having to talk about these two different rates. But the real complexity is there's actually two different rates. But either way, there's nothing magic about 100%.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto and Mr. Hines. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, the 1971 cap that was we were just talking about a number of legislators, is there... and I'm not delusional about the odds of changing this program, but, in addition to elimination, I have carried legislation to remove this 1971 cap, which, I wasn't here, but my understanding was really it was a way to ascertain votes to get the thing passed because it basically grandfathered in downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis at the time, so that value didn't go into the formula. And had it all come in together, the winners and losers would look differently. But now, so much time has passed. In looking at the numbers, I was looking at, say, my city is putting in $11 million or putting in 20, but giving out $11 million. But I see Eden Prairie now and Plymouth and Minnetonka and others are growing. No surprise, it's the south and southwest suburbs of Hennepin that are the biggest losers in the program. And, they have a lot of tax base. So that makes sense. This program, exists to reduce disparities. So are the reason they're growing so fast because, yes, they're building new buildings, but relatively they're not, in my mind, they're not building buildings any faster than any of the rest of the communities. Is it because the effects of the pre-71 cap now as we're seeing those cities on the southwest suburbs of Hennepin really their numbers are going up pretty fast here? If I were Representative Loon and others, I'd really want to look through this chart here. And my guess is even, say, Bloomington must have had a big chunk of its value in place in 71. Is that what's going on here?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, that the effect of the 1971 is obviously static. It never changes. And what it really amounts to is each year 40% of whatever value you've added goes into the pool. So I think it's just that in those cities, their commercial industrial, their adding is just more valuable than in other places. And of course, we're not really looking at growth. If we really sort of tried to isolate growth, we might find plenty of other cities where they really did have a big surge in growth compared to what they had in a few previous years. It's hard to tell by looking at 1 year, but clearly there's just big commercial industrial bases in those places, and they're growing, still continue to grow. And if I could just make one point about the 1971 base, that obvious to some of us that have been in it for a long time, when you were in 1971 when they were considering this legislation, if they didn't put that in, they would have been agreeing on that day to contribute 40% of their tax base into a pool that they wouldn't get. And if you think about it, it's hard to imagine why you would do that. So what they said is, let's agree to put in tax base that comes about going forward. So we freeze the base we have now. Any dollar of growth in our commercial industry base going forward is going to go into a pool that, you know, we'll share. You know, it's a lot easier to imagine that they would have come up with this program than the idea that they wouldn't. But I think, as Representative Wincheski said, sometime, you know, this is now 40-some years later, there may be a question of whether that legitimacy of that subtraction is still appropriate.
Representative Wincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question, if I may. And, you know, Mr. Chair, you and I have worked together on a number of issues related to various taxes, and I know that, you know, there's a similar program in kind of the Rochester area with the sales tax. You know, when you think about the kind of how that's being, you know, part of that is sliced off for a time. And, you know, I think Representative Hertas, you know, hit, you know, one of the, you know, where I'm a little different, I think, than a lot of legislators on this issue. Democrats tend to love it and Republicans tend to hate it. And, you know, I'm in between because I do support reducing disparities in tax base, and that's what LGA does. But this program is always talked about that it's these objectives that Representative Hertas just read, and they're laughable. I mean, they just have not been met. They do not, this does not happen. Had the objectives been straight up and said this is going to be to reduce disparities in tax base, that has been met. I mean, there's no question, I think, and, you know, maybe Mr. Hines could give us a nonpartisan answer on if the program has reduced, disparity in tax base. I mean, I think we can all see it's done that, you know, whether philosophically you think that's a good idea or not. But it's been sold to people as these objectives that are in the handout, you know, none of which have come true. And it's become something that it's the only thing in the property tax system, Mr. Chair, that I know of that has never been changed. Not a sentence in the original legislation has been changed. It is still in law the way it was passed in 1971. Not one word. And we've studied it. And, you know, everything else we change. We change county program aid, local government aid. We change green acres. We change, you know, classifications. What's, you know, home and an acre? You know, how do we do ag? This is, you know, we can't touch it, right? I mean, and I think, you know, Mr. Chair, as you think about this going forward, and, you know, I don't know that people can ever get the votes in any party to change this program because more people win than lose. But, you know, I hope, you know, you will think about it all collectively. I know some of the things I've read, you're looking at trying to reduce agricultural burdens or farmer burdens in the property tax system and some other issues. And I, you know, I hope you just won't forget this program. It is bigger than LGA. And when you combine this program with LGA, we're talking about $1 billion of tax base we're moving around to benefit, you know, folks so that people don't have too big of a tax burden, and I understand that. But, you know, I was just hoping that, Mr. Chair, we could ask Mr. Hines to just remind non-Metro members what the benefit of this program is to non-Metro members, because often people who live in the other 80 counties kind of go get coffee when we talk about fiscal disparities because it's really not their fight. But there is a value in the existence of Metro fiscal disparities, because it really does make LGA's dollars go a lot further than if we pulled that $600 million out. And maybe Mr. Hines can just tell us how non-Metro legislators benefit from the program.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wincheski, that's a good point, that when we do our simulation of what happens if fiscal disparities is gone, in addition to besides being able to sort of make everybody's contribution and distributions set to zero, we also look at a few other things like state aids. And the main one being LGA, that where tax base is a fairly significant piece of determinant of how much LGA you get. So what we found is that that because basically fiscal disparities is on, you know, in aggregate shifting property wealth from communities that have a lot of property wealth two others that don't, that the metro cities are less needy under the LGA formula than they otherwise would be. So that sort of frees up more money, or in the formulas that determine need, it makes more money available to the cities in greater Minnesota. And the last time we did this, mm-hmm. in 2012, it was about a $10 million impact that sort of by Bloomington, which doesn't get any LGA anyway, contributing tax base that goes to Columbia Heights, say, that does get LGA. Columbia Heights doesn't get as much LGA because they've got this tax base from Bloomington that we count when we do their LGA, and therefore they're not as poor as they otherwise would be, and that frees up money for us. So it was about a $10 million impact the last time we looked at this.
Thank you, Representative Lynch.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting Mr. Hines just highlight that. So, you know, in highlighting that, I'm really working against myself because it's helping rural legislators understand why they should want fiscal disparities to continue on. But I think it's just important that we all know that, because, you know, I know that neither you, Mr. Chair, or Democrats are ever going to eliminate this program. It's just a matter of vote counting. But I think we should all be willing to at least, even though most Minnesotans are winning from the program, no matter where they reside, we should at least be willing to be sort of honest about what's really going on. And I appreciate that you've had this hearing and let that happen. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lincheski. So, Chair Lincheski, you know, this whole looking at 1971 as a base date, it sounds like there hasn't been a lot of analysis in looking at these tax bases over time and how they've changed and what a different date would mean and some of those types of things. You know, certainly members, as you think about what you're looking at and working on this session, I encourage you to, especially those of you that are affected by this directly, to take a look at that and maybe dig in a little bit. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all this talk about the increased tax base, etc. The state made a $1 billion investment in one of the cities that's in this area. How much of a tax impact, or how much improved tax base is that billion-dollar investment in Minneapolis, that new stadium, going to have in this scheme of things?
Mr. Hines, and I don't know if we're going to talk about the $500 million investment in another city of the first class, too. Just a little bit of flip back to my colleague over here. So, well, so Mr. Hines.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I believe that building will be exempt public property, so it will not contribute to the tax base. And but, you know, to the extent that it stimulates other development, private development nearby, that would be, an added tax base to the pool that would be 40% of which would be shared. But the building itself will not be shared, nor will the whole city get property tax revenues from that building.
Mr. Hines, was that written into the bill specifically?
Yes.
Full exemption. Representative Quam.
Thank you, and I'm assuming that all of the businesses that were demolished and taken off the tax roll would help negate the new revenue. And to the chair, that actually it's a multi-billion-dollar investment by private entities in that other city, the first class, which, by the way, receives probably a sixth of the per capita LGA from the other cities of the first class. Even the ones smaller receive tens of millions of dollars more in LGA. So, you know, when we look at the whole sum, but no, frankly, a lot of money goes in that's not part of the tax system. It's exempted from it. In greater Minnesota, we've got counties, and very few of them are on the side of the aisle that I sit, where government of this form or other controls 85% of the property. And there are a lot of tax issues that this committee probably could address. But this one is very informative and entertaining today.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam's question reminds me it might be worth just stating that if you haven't looked in the runs yet, you might note that Minneapolis is actually a net contributor to this program for the current year and has been for a couple years now. Over the time, Minneapolis has been back and forth, but they're typically a small net contributor or a small net recipient, not much either side of the equation, where St. Paul has always been one of the, probably the biggest recipient in dollar terms, not necessarily per capita, but in dollar terms since the beginning. One other point that I maybe should have worked in is I've talked about this being in place throughout the metropolitan area. There are a few exceptions to who's included in this program. Some number of years ago, the legislature specifically excluded cities that made no attempt to get commercial industrial development. So there was this feeling that cities could, you know, zone out commercial industrial and get their tax base, their CI tax base from the pool only. So they put in place a law saying that the Met Council, together with the Department of Revenue, who I think has basically ceded that the decision making to the Met Council to decide who consciously excludes CI development, and there's about a handful of about six cities that don't participate because of that. Sunfish Lake being maybe the most well known, but the others are typically out around small communities around Lake Minnetonka, or I think along the St. Croix. And then there are a couple on the periphery of the seven county area. So the city of New Prague, I believe, is out. Is even though part of it is within Scott County, the city of Northfield is out, even though a little bit of it is within Dakota County. So there are those two exceptions. And then another exception that's sort of on a different scale is airport property at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and the St. Paul Downtown Airport does not contribute to the pool, even though it's commercial industrial. And I think those are the other the main exclusions. City of South St. Paul is an interesting case because they were in a dire economic straits when this program was created, and they were in some kind of a federal disaster, sort of economic disaster area. I'm not sure the name of it right now. They did not have to contribute. They were allowed to receive all along. Finally, in the mid-90s, they were put into the program, but given a base of like 1995. So their growth is compared to 1990, some date like 95 compared to the 71 base that everybody else uses.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hines. So members, I've got a couple of members here. I just want to look around. Is there anybody here who would like to talk about this in the audience that wanted to come and talk about fiscal disparities generally today? I don't want to. Okay. I just want to make sure we fit you in. I've got two members. We'll get those questions, then we'll come over to you, sir. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back a little bit to the goals, and it was kind of touched on, but I do recall learning about this a little bit. Full disclosure, I'm an Anoka County legislator. the bidding. Yeah, I know. When it was implemented, part of the goal was to get rid of all the bidding wars that were happening because cities were paying more for contracts than they were actually worth. And so that's another benefit that it was kind of alluded to here, but not really stated in that way, which is how it was put to me. And so you also mentioned on another slide that it is really hard to calculate kind of the world without fiscal disparities because, you know, where would those businesses have located without it? And another thing, you know, the benefits of parks. I know water in the sense that there are a lot of wetlands that provide water for the whole area, and that land can't be developed and used to get property tax and things like that. So when we're trying to talk about ways to reform, because it sounds like this is, among other things here, a complicated issue, I just would want to know if we just got rid of it entirely, it seems that the counties that are gainers would just be coming to the state asking for more LGA or asking for more in some way from the state. So if we are going to look at reform for this, it seems that we would want to do it in such a way that there'd be comprehensive property tax reform. I know that's said a lot, and people are like, oh, that's never going to happen. But have there been studies or something that looks at fiscal disparities in the entire realm of property taxes and local government and on all of that that says, hey, this would be a better system? And kind of what are, what, where can we go from here?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen, I can't really think of any study that would fall into that category of really trying to look at the entire system, including fiscal disparities and what you might replace it with or part of it with.
Thank you, Mr. Hines and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Whalen and Mr. Hines. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to remind you that you referred to Representative Leshensky as Chair Leshensky, and that title has sunsetted. So let you know about that. But to finish up on the point, she referred to she referred to $1 billion of tax base, but it's $1 billion of taxes that's being redistributed. And, you know, for those communities that are really on the very edges of this seven-county area, some of which I represent, you know, we are the Property Tax Committee, and we're talking about delivering fairness in a system. What we've got is communities out in the district that I represent that actually are 40 years out from receiving any regional infrastructure, still 40 years today. And so these communities have embarked with the consent of Met Council and whatnot, have been granted permits, they've built wastewater treatment facilities, and these are enterprise funds that are operating at a deficit. These communities don't get fiscal disparities. They're not eligible under the formula for LGA. They're taking on the burdens of their own infrastructure, and it's inherently a problem because these same communities, as a percent of their household income, are disproportionately burdened with property tax. In the district that I represent, it's 5%, unlike the statewide average of 1.5% or 2%. So when the suggestion is made that maybe there's some common ground, maybe there's a bipartisan bill here that can be authored to start to target some of the relief for these communities that have been part of this program for more than 40 years and have benefited actually nothing. And there's no prospect of there ever being nothing, and they're going to continue being a donor community and being an ATM for redistribution.
So thank you, Representative Hertas. I didn't hear a question, but I think you're headed to the workshop.
I think I.
We're gonna squeeze in Representative Joaquim here too. She got on the list, so Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'll be very quick. Mr. Hines, has there been a look at? I know anytime you have a formula and you start to see dramatic outliers that stay there for a long time, like Hennepin County only getting 75% back, Anoka County getting double what they put in. I know with LGA, they spent a few years looking at the formula and trying to balance that out so that you don't have those tremendous outliers. Has there been a working group looking at that?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquim, there's not been a working group looking at anything like that, but I maybe should, it maybe is a good segue to mention that a study was commissioned in 2011 that by money was appropriated to the Department of Revenue, and they hired an outside consultant, an out-of-state consultant, to do a study of fiscal disparities. And the main kind of conclusion that I part of the study that sort of added to what we didn't already know was they looked at different kinds of properties in terms of what kind of property taxes they yielded versus how much they cost the city or the governments, mostly the city, in terms of providing services. So the conclusion sort of, to get to the bottom line of this part of their study at any rate, was that commercial property mostly did not pay for itself in terms of property taxes generated compared to service burdens placed upon the governments where they're located, and especially with commercial properties did not. So there was this allegation that, well, did it make sense to be taking 40%
of the tax base away from commercial property, given that, as it was, the cities were kind of coming out behind on the deal. And their conclusion kind of was they'd be coming out behind even if we didn't have fiscal disparities. We just don't, you know, they just imposed too high a burden. But it's certainly exacerbated by fiscal disparities. So it was a study that maybe had multiple purposes, but I think that was the main takeaway that most of us came from, that was sort of new information. But in terms of trying to talk about the overall distribution and how that might be changed over, how it might be trying to change it over time, I don't believe that they looked at that at all.
Representative Joaquin? So, Mr. Hines, in what you were saying there, did I hear? Maybe I heard incorrectly. Did it sound like there may have been sensed some built-in disincentive for growth in those communities among the CI properties?
Mr. Chair, that might be something you could infer, but I think the conclusion also was that there didn't seem to be much evidence of people not pursuing commercial properties, even though you know, in some ways it didn't seem to make sense for a community to want commercial because it was going to be more expensive to provide services than it was going to get. Still, we find that places do tend to make accommodations to allow commercial industrial to have, or commercial. This is commercial, because industrial was a very different story. Industrial property does tend to provide more revenue than it cost to service. But commercial, there didn't seem to be a lack of commercial property in this area because of people sort of shutting it out, I don't think.
Thank you. Sir, if you want to come up, and Mr. Hines, if you'll hold on, there may be more questions that materialize for you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Mike Gamash. I'm Anoka County Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the committee. Prior to my election to the county board this November, I served as the mayor of the city of Andover. So you saw on the board that Anoka County and Andover were two of the cities that areas of this that participate, and yes, we do benefit from it as well. I'm also employed full time with the with a company, a big company in Wayzata called General Mills. So every relationship that we have in our lives, whether it's your spouse, your coworker, and even government, boils down to one thing, and that's expectations. Expectations of the bodies, whether it's the county government or the city government. And we're constantly being measured as to whether we meet those expectations and meet those other people's expectations. In government, we hear a lot about the failure to meet some of our citizens' expectations, and that can be potholes on your city streets. It can be snow removal or sanding the roads, as we all experienced this morning. But when it comes to our most important local services, fiscal disparities was created so that all the citizens of this metro area, regardless of where they live, could have the expectations met for their police forces, their fire departments, education, and for safe roads. The fiscal disparities program that's been well described this morning for you all was created in 1971. And in 1971, if you looked around the metro area, it would have been a lot different than it is today. There was some talk about places like Eden Prairie, which I grew up in the small suburb of the western suburbs of Hopkins. Eden Prairie at that time was wide open. There wasn't anything down there. And now, today, we're seeing large freeways, large highways, and we're seeing great commercial growth in areas like Eden Prairie. This regional approach that fiscal disparities brings about, this tax-based sharing approach that fiscal disparities brings about, was because of the shopping centers, the airports, the freeway interchanges, in some cases sports stadiums, although I understand that that's not the case with the new Viking Stadium. But it also meant that we could have a balance in our metro area. And that's what I think it has created, and I think that's what's been the benefit of it all. Communities with low tax bases must impose higher tax rates to deliver the same services as communities with higher tax rates, or bases, excuse me. These high tax rates make poor communities less attractive for places for business to locate or expand, and that exacerbates the problem. Sharing the CI tax base can reduce this. And the competition as well, as Representative Whalen had mentioned too. There was a lot of competition back in those days, and that's why, one of the reasons why this program was put into place. You've got a really good explanation of how fiscal disparities works. The 40% goes in. And in my city that I represented for 14 years, and I still represent as a county commissioner, in 1971 we did not exist. We were not a city. We were a township. So our base was zero at some point in time. Now today, 40% obviously is what we put in. And I've heard over the years, being down here in St. Paul, talking with committees like yours and also Senate committees, was that really this makes the outer suburbs not participate and not want to build their commercial tax base. That is not the case. As a mayor, we are always looking to build our commercial tax base. We want businesses to come to our city where we have some ability to attract. We don't have a lot of state highways or freeways that can attract some of the larger businesses. But in Andover alone, in the last 5 years, we've brought two large industrial companies into our city so that we could raise our tax base. That improves it for everybody, including improves it for the fiscal disparities as well. One of the other things that Anoka County provides is that we are really a wetland area, as, again, Representative Whalen had mentioned earlier. And a lot of the water that comes into Hennepin County and other areas south of us comes through Anoka County. It gets recharged in Anoka County. And it goes down into the wetlands, or it goes down into the watersheds and everything, and that's how that all gets recharged. That's why we have more open space in Anoka County. Some of it because we cannot develop it. It cannot be developed due to the fact that it is wetlands. But that makes it important, and that's why fiscal disparities, in my mind, over the 40 years that it's been in place, has worked, and it is working. I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen changes at the legislature. While we have seen changes to other programs, we have not seen changes to fiscal disparities. We would like to keep it. In Anoka County, our philosophy is and has been that if there's comprehensive property tax reform, we would be supportive and looking towards that, and then perhaps that would take in fiscal disparities. But without that comprehensive plan, we don't expect that we should see any changes to fiscal disparities this year or in the near future. Thank you for your time, and I don't have all the answers to questions, but I'd be more than happy to take any.
Thank you, Commissioner Gamache.
Yes, thank you.
And Representative Dabney, I know, has a question. I don't know what it's for.
Mr. Chair, it's not for Commissioner Gamache, so if any others have questions to the
any questions directly for Commissioner Gamache? Okay, thank you. thank you, Commissioner. Anyone else that would like to speak here on this topic today? Representative Dabney?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to correct the record before it gets out too far. The state did not make a $1 billion investment in the Viking Stadium. The state made, in round numbers, a $500 million investment in the Viking Stadium, and the taxpayers of Minneapolis are making a $500 million investment in the stadium, Minneapolis. The land that the new Viking Stadium is on is tax-exempt because it's a public structure. The land that it is on was the same site as the old stadium for the Vikings and the Twins, which was a public structure and was tax exempt. So that land has been off of the property tax rolls for 40 years? Probably, may even date to around 1971, I'm not sure, ironically enough.
Well, 1980 was a Viking Stadium, right? The original one?
Was it 80?
86.
Okay. No. Really? Okay, well, you know.
Mr. Hines
so
is 82.
I trust.
Yeah.
And while there may be differences of opinion and voting records on that, I voted against the Viking Stadium. No one can deny that it has sparked hundreds of millions of dollars in development in that area already, even when that big ugly monstrosity isn't yet completed. And 40% of that will go to other districts and other cities and other counties. And as Mr. Hines pointed out, Minneapolis is a net loser in this program. So before we got into some idea that the state was giving undue benefits to Minneapolis, Minneapolis pays far more in taxes to the state than we get back through any program. And in general, when we look at statewide aids and credits, of course, Hennepin County gets far less back than it pays in on any program you care to choose across the state budgets. Just wanted to correct that record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Well, members, in the interest of equity and realizing that each of our last meetings went over time by about 5 minutes each, and it's about 10 minutes to 10, we're going to have time disparities today. And members, with that, thank you, Mr. Hines. Thank you, members. The meeting's adjourned.